Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:31. It's May 7th, and we're going to finish up respiratory chapter, move on to digestion today. And let's see, today's the 7th, and you're 2 weeks away from the last test in the class. All right, so we're almost done. Congratulations. So I would still keep studying a little bit every day, okay, because especially that Wednesday group, right, the group that has lab on Wednesday, you're going to get the last lecture exam as well as the last practicum on the same day. And I might even end up giving you a quiz or extra credit quiz on that day as well. That's not such a big deal. But the practicum and the lecture exam. So make sure you print out all the study guides for your lecture exam. Make sure you see how much you have to know. And then you just have to tackle that. All the weekly assignments should be open. If something has closed in Blackboard and you need to open it back up, let me know and I'll redo it. But I think the classes or all those weeks will be there until after the final, in case you want to look. Okay, any questions on the schedule? Oh, what's going to be on exam number 4? Chapters 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, and 25. And what are we on right now? I don't know what we're on right now. We're on 22 and we'll be on 23, so just two more chapters after maybe today. Maybe next week, too, I'll talk about digestive system a little bit. Okay, so no questions. Fantastic. We're not quite done with respiratory system. Almost done. I don't think I have to show you any more figures, okay, because I don't think we have any figures of this stuff. Maybe a little bit. Okay, so here we see a nice heart, right? And what's that most anterior vessel coming off the base of the heart? What is that? Yeah, the pulmonary trunk. Yeah, just probably memorize that one, along with those three other items. What were the three other items that you should memorize? Let me know if it's too dark. You should know the, what's this here? Apex, you should know what this is called, that's the anterior longitudinal sulcus, and then this is the base. All right, so here you know for sure that's anterior, so that's the pulmonary trunk. Then here is the aorta. And how about that first branch off the aorta? What is this first branch? Okay, it's going to go to the head and the arm. So it's the brachiocephalic. And then the first branch off the brachiocephalic is this thing. This is really what I want you to know. What is this vessel here? That's the common carotid, right? And then the common carotid bifurcates into the internal and external carotid. Internal takes blood to the brain, two of only four vessels that bring blood to the brain, and the external just takes blood outside the cranium. All right, so you see this junction right here between the internal, external, and the common carotid arteries. This is what we call the carotid sinus. It's carotid sinus. And it's important for a couple of reasons. Just like the arch of the aorta, it has special sensors in it for pressure, because when pressure increases, these vessels stretch a little bit. So these are stretch receptors. So your mind gets an idea of what the pressure is. There are also chemoreceptors for carbon dioxide and oxygen in these receptors. So I want you to be aware of these two important locations. All right, so that's for the carotid sinus. The second reason the carotid sinus is important is because of where it's positioned and the geometry of the carotid sinus, meaning just the shape. The carotid sinus is a very common place where we find vascular disease, maybe even the most common place. And so ultrasound departments are imaging this part of somebody's body, which is, what region would you call this? Would you call this an appendage, a trunk? What would you call this area right here? This is the cervical region, right, or your neck. So ultrasounds are being done all the time in the cervical region to take a look at this carotid sinus to see if there's any plaques in there, what's the blood flow like. And because it causes a lot of problems. Now, the terrible thing is if there is a plaque in the carotid sinus and it breaks off and it goes into the internal carotid, what's the result of that going to be? and this is commonly, and this commonly happens. Yeah, then that thrombus lodges in the brain someplace, and that part of the brain doesn't get blood or oxygen, and it dies. We call that a, what do we call that? Yeah, that's a stroke, right? When that, when you get a thrombus in the brain. Okay, so this is a really important area for those two reasons. It has receptors, and it causes a lot of disease. Okay, the respiratory control center is in the medulla. Sometimes you could call this the vasomotor center or cardioregulatory center. It's right here, as well as the respiratory centers are in the pons and the medulla. So these things function to monitor and adjust your heart rate and blood pressure and breathing. Because remember, you don't have to think about breathing every single time, every time you take a breath. You can. All right. The diaphragm is a skeletal muscle, so it is under voluntary control, but there's a backup system between the pons and the medulla, which then stimulates the diaphragm to contract rhythmically. So when you're sleeping, you don't have to think about taking a breath. All right, so that's where the respiratory center is. Oh, guess what? I'm sure we talked about that when we looked at the medulla and the pons. All right, so that's what controls breathing, and so it gets input from sensors in the carotid sinus and the aortic arch to help regulate respiration in those two areas. So what's so it gets information from these receptors, makes a decision on what to do, like increase ventilation or decrease ventilation, and so then it makes a decision, and it sends that decision out to that muscle that's most important for inspiration. What's the muscle most important for inspiration? It is for inspiration. It is the diaphragm. I'm not sure if I heard diaphragm or not, but what I really want you to know is what's the name of that nerve that goes to the diaphragm that allows you to breathe? Yeah, phrenic nerve. And you got to know where that is for the practical test. All right, so phrenic nerve goes to the diaphragm. And remember that little saying when we looked at spinal nerves, what's the origin of the phrenic nerve? It is C3, 4, and 5. And C3, 4, and 5 keeps you alive. That's right, allows you to breathe. All right, so what are some of these inputs that I have been talking about from the aortic bodies and the carotid bodies? All right, so there are chemoreceptors that can monitor CO2. They can also monitor pH. And as the pH decreases, what does that mean? We haven't gone over that in this class, but pH is a measure of acidity. And it's just a nice simple number, 1 through 14. That's why we come up with it. And as that number gets smaller, what happens to the acidity of a solution as that number gets smaller? I don't think anybody would know unless you take maybe a chemistry class or something. Yeah, as the pH number decreases, the acidity increases. So it's kind of a funny mathematical relationship. So I have a down arrow for pH right here. What does that mean in terms of acidity? Is acidity increasing or decreasing? The acidity is increasing. That's right. So your body is becoming more acidic. It's producing more CO2. The respiratory center, right, and the medulla and the pons will then excite or stimulate ventilation or breathing. And the most powerful chemical for breathing is CO2 concentration. You could probably guess there's another chemical that's really important to monitor in your body. So we got CO2 and acidity. What might be another chemical that you would think of? And you know what? This is the one that I always think of first. And I always thought of this as being the most important, but I was way wrong. Oxygen. Yeah, oxygen you need to stay alive. Your body monitors it, but only when it gets to drastically low levels. So the most important chemical for regulating ventilation is CO2. And if it increases a little bit, then that stimulates ventilation. Okay. And those are due to the central receptors, right, in the, okay, and actually there are central receptors in the medulla. That's what we mean by central. The carotid and aortic bodies are what we call peripheral receptors. They're not in the central nervous system. All right, so the peripheral receptors are important for monitoring blood pressure, but also oxygen. But notice when oxygen changes a little bit, it has no effect on ventilation. There has to be, what, a huge decrease in oxygen before that will stimulate ventilation. Okay, and a lot of people kind of know that. For instance, if you're in a swimming pool and you enter a contest to see how far somebody can swim underwater before taking a breath, or maybe you're a free diver out on the ocean, you go fishing without a scuba tank, and people know how to hold their breath for a really long period of time. And it can be very dangerous, and people die because they mess around with these receptors. So let me describe what can happen. So what's the most sensitive chemical that will adjust your ventilation? It will actually give you an urgency to breathe. CO2. That's right. When CO2 builds up in your body, it's going to give you urgency to breathe. And we can get rid of CO2 in our body by hyperventilating. By breathing very rapidly, we'll lose a lot of CO2 compared to normal, which then means you won't have the feeling that you have to take a breath for a longer period of time after you hyperventilate. So what some of these divers do is that they hyperventilate drastically, get rid of a lot of CO2 so that they can stay really long underwater without that terrible feeling of having to take a breath, right? And they dive down deep into the ocean, holding their breath. The CO2 begins to rise, but not enough to increase ventilation or to rise to the level of somebody's consciousness. But as they're swimming underwater, guess what molecule they are using up in their body? They are using up oxygen, right? And that oxygen is necessary to maintain consciousness. And these free divers can run out of oxygen before they sense that there is an increase in CO2 and they pass out. And so then what happens if you're 30 feet, 40 feet underwater and you pass out? Well, then what happens when you pass out, right, then the autonomic centers take over respiration and you start to breathe underwater, and that's not a good thing, right? So that leads to drowning. So you got to be a little bit careful of that. Do we have any free divers in here? No? No fishermen that like to dive down in the ocean? Okay. So just remember, CO2 is the most important chemical for regulating ventilation, and we can get rid of it by hyperventilating, and we'll lose that urgency to breathe. But nonetheless, you still need oxygen. Oh, here is something else, too. All right, so every once in a while, somebody is brain dead. For instance, like the cerebrum is dead. Blood flow didn't get to it, drug overdoses, who knows why, the brain might die, but it might die. And the brainstem might still be alive, like the medulla and the pons. So even though somebody's brain is dead, they're really no longer with us. They can't appreciate things around them in their environment. They can't react to things in their environment very well, right? But the medulla and pons are still functioning. And what does the medulla and pons have? They have the respiratory centers, right? So even though somebody's brain dead, they could still breathe on their own, right, if the medulla and pons is normal. And every once in a while, unfortunately, sometimes you have to make a decision to take somebody off of life support. Maybe a family member, right, has a really difficult decision because they might be breathing on their own. And when you take somebody off of a respirator, even though they're dead, even though their brain is dead, then, okay, they stop breathing. What happens to oxygen then when they stop breathing? It starts to decrease and decrease some more and decrease and decrease, and then all of a sudden here is this drastic decrease in oxygen that the central receptors, right, and the peripheral receptors monitor, and that stimulates the respiratory center for that dead person to take some very serious gasps of air. Right, it's very startling to see. We call that agonal breathing. Like a breathing that somebody can do after they're actually dead for a long period of time. And if you're a family member in that room, guess how you feel? Here's your loved one all of a sudden appearing to wake up and take some breaths after you've just gone through this agonizing decision, and it's very startling. But what's happening there? It's just this reflex that's happening very low in the brain, the medulla and the pons, and that person is not experiencing anything, is not trying to come back breathing, right? That's just what we call agonal respiration or agonal breaths that just happen automatically. Okay, what are some other things that can regulate breathing? Well, the higher centers, like the cerebral cortex, because the diaphragm is skeletal muscle, it's under voluntary control. And we all could stop breathing right now, so we could all hold our breath, and we'd have an urgency to breathe. But if we're really serious, we could still hold our breath, even longer, and just like that diver, we would pass out. But that's not such a big deal, because as soon as you pass out, what's going to happen? The respiratory centers will take over, the more automatic centers, and you'll start breathing even though you have passed out. So I know that some children do that to freak their parents out. Oh, you're smiling. Did you do that to your parents? No, you didn't do that to your parents. Okay. Anybody do that to your parents in here? You're not admitting to it. Okay. Well, you can, because the cerebral cortex can override the medulla and the pons, at least while you are conscious. All right, emotional stimulus via the hypothalamus, and you know where the hypothalamus is connected to the respiratory center. And so emotional stimulus regulates ventilation, usually increases ventilation, produces maybe a gasp, for instance. How many times have you been watching a movie or somebody next to you watching a movie, and they do what when a very shocking scene is shown on the screen? They go like that, and hopefully you're just not ready to eat something when that happens. Okay, so emotional stimulus can stimulate the respiratory centers. Something else, proprioceptors. Okay, and proprioceptors are like muscle spindle apparatus and stretch receptors in tendons that you have all over your body. So this is a general sense. It gives you the sense of body position, or if you're moving a joint rapidly, it sends that information to the brain. And you could stimulate those proprioceptors right now just sitting still and just kind of almost passively moving your legs and arms around, right? You're stimulating those proprioceptors, but since you don't have any weights in your hands, right, or on your legs, are you really working?
No,
you're not really exercising, right? But you're just moving your joints around, and that goes to the respiratory center, and that will increase ventilation even though you're not really doing any work, right? But that will help you prepare for an activity where you need to increase ventilation. All right, so proprioceptors are important. Other kinds of receptors are like touch, pain, and temperature. So for instance, has anybody ever poked you in the side? And what did you do before you smacked them? You probably moved and you went like that, right? So that stimulates another kind of gasp reflex, or pain. Right, if you experience pain, you'll increase respiration. And temperature, let's say I take an ice cube and I put it on the back of your neck. Not quite painful stimulus, but it's a cold stimulus. Guess what you would do? The first thing you would do is you would inhale, right? You would gasp. We call that the gasp reflex. And so your body responds to temperature. And I think of a condition, I was really startled and very happy to hear about the end result of this. A number of years ago, there are a number of people out in Marina Del Rey, and it's a harbor. Marina Del Rey is a harbor like Newport Beach. And there's a couple of boats out there that are big, and they can hold parties, like wedding parties, end of year school parties, all kinds of parties. And it was a Christmas party, and everybody was all dressed up, tuxedo and fancy gowns and things like that, and they had a band playing. And all of a sudden, the boat caught on fire, and it was in the engine room. And the engine then couldn't pull the boat over to shore. They let the passengers out, right? And this boat wasn't seaworthy. It wasn't on the ocean. It was just in the harbor, thank goodness. And so the ship was burning. So guess what all the passengers had to do? There were no lifeboats even. They had to jump off the boat in their tuxedos and fancy gowns and things like that, okay? And fortunately, nobody died. And I was just really grateful and amazed at that. This was in the middle of the night, so it was pitch black, right? Can you imagine jumping into the ocean and not even be able to see where you're going, and you're all dressed up like that? Okay. And why I am so amazed is because when you jump off a boat into the water, okay, you feel what, especially the ocean around here? You feel cold, right? You feel this big rush of cold, and that will stimulate what? A gasp reflex. And after you jump off the boat, what happens to your head after you jump off of a boat? It probably sinks underwater, right? You go kaplunk, your head's underwater, you have that gasp reflex, and you take a deep breath, and a lot of seawater could just enter their lungs. And I was really surprised nobody drowned, because we all know about that gasp reflex, unless they were told to hold their breath before they jumped, right? And then you can override it. And then I figured out probably what happened, what saved all those lives, is that there wasn't a lifeboat, but before they jumped, they put on a life preserver. which probably kept their head above the water surface, so when they jumped into that nice freezing cold water, they went, but their head was above water. So that was nice. And then they did a little dog paddle to shore to get out of the water. Okay, so that's the respiratory system. All right, so be sure you know this carotid sinus and where these carotid bodies are. Okay, I don't know if I'm going to test you on it. Your book doesn't make a big deal of it, but clinically, it's very important. Question.
How long the medulla and the pons can hold even the person?
How long can the medulla and pons be functional even though the person is dead? Well, if they're on a respirator and they're getting nutrition through a vein or something like that, gee whiz, I don't know, it could be years. I would have to do a Google. It could be 5 years, maybe 10 years. It could be a very long period of time.
But when the person pass away, we put a finger on the nose, they're no more breathing.
Well, if they're not breathing, then they're not breathing for a long period of time, for sure they are dead. So that's one measure of being alive or dead, but maybe not always a good measure. Okay, because if I stop breathing right now, I'm not breathing, but if somebody does CPR on me, you can keep my brain alive for a long time until I get to the hospital, and then hopefully I can be revived. Right, so breathing sometimes is a good sign, but not always is a good sign, because somebody might be breathing very slowly. Okay, especially if they're cold, if they lose body temperature. Okay, so yeah, you can't come up with pronounce anybody dead just by looking at their respirations. Okay, what was the most interesting case that I got involved with? Maybe in lab if we have time. I'll tell you about this one case that I was asked to deal with. Oh gosh, I guess I got to tell you. Okay, so I was developing MRI techniques. Have you ever heard of MRI before? Right, you put somebody in this big magnet and you make pictures on their insides. Well, my specialty was not making pictures, but actually measuring chemicals inside people and then making maps of those chemicals. So I was measuring ATP. And what do you know about ATP?
Energy.
Yeah, energy keeps people alive, right? So that's my definition of life. If a cell has ATP, it's alive. If a cell doesn't have ATP, it's dead. That's just my molecular understanding. So there was a couple rushing to the hospital because the woman was about ready to deliver, and they rushed into the emergency room with their car, the parking lot there, just as an ambulance was rushing out to get to another accident, and they collided, and it killed the mom. And it put the dad into a coma. So here was a baby ready to be born. The mom was dead. All the people were there, so they rushed the mom into emergency room, did a cesarean section, and now they have a baby, right, that's not breathing. But the heart was beating, and so they want to know, is that baby alive or dead? What are you going to do with that baby? You don't even know the name. The parents aren't there to say what to do with the baby. And so they put the baby on a respirator. Respiratory therapy was there in an incubator, and the baby was alive for a number of days. And I said, oh, I can tell if the baby's alive or dead by doing what? Measuring ATP in their brain, right? So we did this fancy MRI technique, and sure enough, there's a lot of ATP left in the brain. It's almost like a normal brain, but there is no electrical activity, there is no reflex activity in this person, but the brain, in terms of its chemistry, was absolutely normal, but it just wouldn't function. So I said, yeah, I wouldn't take the baby off of life support. But baby eventually died. I think the father finally woke up and was able to deal with that really terrible situation. Okay, so when you think of death, there can be all kinds of different ways that you want to measure or consider death. That was just one way of thinking about it in a molecular sense. So the baby probably was alive, but, you know, during parturition, newborn infants can be starved for oxygen for pretty long periods of time without dying, right? They can have an umbilical cord wrapped around their neck, and maybe a minute or two later, maybe even 3 or 4 minutes later, it becomes untied, the baby will be just fine. No big deal. So there's probably something in babies' brains that protect them from becoming unconscious, like turning their brain off. And we do that with patients right now. Sometimes if somebody has a brain injury and we want to preserve their brain until it can heal a little bit, then we put them in an induced coma. Maybe you've heard of that, right? So this baby was in like a normally induced coma to protect the brain, and nobody knew how to bring the baby back out from that coma. But the brain was normal.
In Vietnam, you know, like the doctor go to the patient, and he put the finger on the nose.
Yeah.
And he put the finger on the carotid.
Oh, nice.
And he
nice central pressure, pulse.
And he put the hand on your left side of your heart. If three of them doesn't work, he say, okay, this person is dead.
Okay. I like that.
Is it the same?
Three measures is better than one, okay? So, sure. And, you know, there's kind of another saying. I don't know if this is an old wives' tale, which I don't know if it's true or not, and that is you can't really pronounce somebody dead until they're dead and cold, okay? So that could be another measure because their body could be just so slow that you can't measure some of these respirations. And, okay, and if all those measures don't show life and the person's cold, then that's a pretty good indication that the person is dead. Yeah, but coming up with a definition of death sometimes is difficult to do. Okay. There was another interesting case, the Terry Schiavo case. Probably you've heard of Terry Schiavo, and maybe sometime I can talk about that. That was in Florida. All right, so let's move out of respiratory system and move into digestive system. Yeah, I'll put that away like so. Okay, so here are the components of the digestive system, right, on the word slide. And here we see parts of the digestive system. It's composed of the alimentary canal. This is the tube that food passes through, okay, from your mouth to your anus, and it's processed. Nutrients and water is taken out of that food and put into the body. That's a primary digestive organ, but there are some accessory organs as well. There are some things that help and aid in that digestion. Namely, the liver is one important organ. The salivary glands, not part of the alimentary canal, but these are accessory structures. Right? The pancreas, right? And spleen. I don't know why the spleen is here, but it's on this diagram so you can see it. Oh, I know why it's on this diagram. Okay. Because of the relationship of the spleen to the large intestine. This is kind of a special area right here. See this 90-degree bend. And so this 90-degree bend is closest to the spleen. So guess what the name of this 90-degree bend is? It's splenic something, right? And a 90-degree bend is what? Flexing. So that's a flexure. We call that the splenic flexure. What would you call this bend over here, this 90-degree bend in the large intestine here? Would you call this a splenic flexure? This would be the... Well, what's a good name for liver? We don't want to say liver. Yeah, so here is the hepatic flexure right here, closest to the liver. All right, so you got the alimentary canal. You got a lot of lymphatic tissue, malt associated with all of these different parts of the tube. Here is a special aggregation of lymphatic tissue. This is the appendix, and sometimes it becomes inflamed. One of the jobs of the liver is to produce a detergent, right, and that's called bile, because when we have oils and lipids in our body or in our diet, remember oil and lipids, oil and water doesn't mix, so in order for you to absorb those oils or fats, they have to be emulsified. And bile is an emulsifier. I call it a detergent. That's one way of thinking of it, because that's what you use around the house, right, to get oil or fatty stuff out of clothes when you wash them in a washing machine. So that's the job of bile, so that lipids can dissolve in water, emulsification. And it's produced by the liver, stored in the gallbladder until you're in a fed state, when there's food in the digestive tract. That's when bile goes down there, even though the liver is making it all the time. Okay, what about teeth? Is that an accessory structure or part of the alimentary canal? It's accessory structure, right, for breaking food down into smaller pieces. Okay, salivary glands, accessory structure. Salivary glands produce saliva, which has mucus in it, and sometimes digestive enzymes that can break down sugars for a short period of time before they get into the stomach. But since there's mucus there, it acts as a lubricant, so food can go from the oral cavity all the way down to the stomach via this tube right here, which is the esophagus. All right, so here is the esophagus. That is part of the alimentary canal. All right, so we got large intestine. I see large intestine. Let's look through some of these things. Gallbladder, liver, pancreas, small intestine, stomach, esophagus, pharynx is your throat. All right, that's the passageway for both air and things that we eat, salivary glands, teeth, tongue. Good. All right, so we talked about all of these things. Some other details, the small intestine right here has three divisions, and you see them right here, duodenum, jejunum, and ileum. The one that's closest to the stomach or the most proximal division is the duodenum. And the one that is closest to the large intestine is the most distal part of the small intestine. We call that the ileum. And the part that's in between, the middle division, is what we call the jejunum. Yeah, and let's see. We didn't talk about the large intestine. Let's look at it really close. Here is the ascending. Here is the transverse. Here is the descending. And then it goes through this little squiggle right here. We call that the sigmoid colon. And then we have the rectum that stores feces. And when it's time to eliminate, these feces move through the anal canal and out the anus. And then that's a good job when that happens. Okay. Well, in blood vessels, we had to look at layers. And layers of the digestive tract are very important, too, because there's a lot of different kinds of disease processes that can happen with the digestive system, including cancer, cancer of the large bowel. And in order to understand something about that cancer, you got to know what layers are involved. So you got to know what the normal layers are in order to understand what the pathological layers are. All right. So when the digestive system is operating normally, we really take it for granted, right? We can just live a normal life. But if you have some kind of disease of the digestive tract, it will really mess your life up. For instance, if you have colon cancer, of course, that can be fatal. But you could have irritable bowel syndrome or colitis, right? Inflammations of the intestines. And that will just make somebody's life miserable when they are actually in an episode of those particular cases. All right, so let's look at some of these layers. Where are the layers at? Okay, so here are the layers. And pretty much everywhere along the alimentary canal, you're going to have these layers. So the outermost layer is just a capsule, like we've seen on other kind of organs. We call this the serosa. There is the peritoneal membrane that completely surrounds the serosa, and it's kind of slippery, so your intestines can move around without inflaming. So you have serosa, and then you have the muscularis externa. So I see some smooth muscles right here. So here is the length of the tube. This is the longitudinal section. And so these fibers go along the long axis, so we call this the longitudinal. And the ones that are encircling the digestive tract, then we call this the circular smooth muscle. All right, so where did I start? Oh, I started way down over here. All right, muscularis externa. We're going backwards. Other things that you see, all these yellow structures, and my goodness, are these yellow things to you?
No.
Huh?
No.
Yeah, they are nerves, right? And the digestive tract has many, many nerves because these nerves help control how material passes through the alimentary canal. And as a matter of fact, there are more nerves in the digestive tract than there are in the spinal cord. That's pretty amazing. And it's called the myenteric nerve plexus. And for a long time, people thought that the mind actually existed in the digestive tract because there were so many nerves in the digestive system. Now we know it's just for controlling contraction of the longitudinal muscles, circular muscles. And also, there are some other muscles a little bit deeper, and we're going to get to that in just a second. All right, so you got serosa, muscularis externa, all right, and then submucosa is right here. Submucosa has a lot of blood vessels. It has glands, and it has lymphatic tissue to fight infection. And it also has some more smooth muscle, and this is called the muscularis mucosae. Oh, I got that in the mucosa. All right, it's not in the mucosa layer. It's in the submucosa. All right, so here's the first layer of the submucosa. Here's some more connective tissue with glands and lymphatic tissue, and then the very deepest layer is just an epithelium that lines this canal. And depending on the part of the digestive system, it can have different shapes and different forms. Sometimes it's a It's a stratified squamous epithelium like in the mouth, or it could be a simple cuboidal epithelium. All depends on what part of the digestive tract we are talking about. Usually it is just a simple cuboidal epithelium. Okay. And that lamina propria that is in the mucosa as well as the submucosa, right, is just loose connective tissue that holds everything together. Okay, so I'm sure this is a nice exam figure. All right, so this nerve plexus controls how food moves around, and there are two main ways that propulsion works. And it's controlled by that smooth muscle. If we have a bolus of food in some proximal division of the intestine, and it moves to a more distal location, and then it moves again to a more distal location because the smooth muscle is just pushing it along the digestive tract, we call that peristalsis, right? So peristalsis is just a one-way motion from mouth to anus through the digestive tract that we see over here. The second kind of motion is a little bit different, right? So we have a number of contractions, a number of different segments along the digestive tract. And so let's just label this first segment a light color, the second one a dark color, and then the third one another light color. And it is just staying right there. It's not moving. Peristalsis is not operating. All right. And part of the digestive tract is to mix food up with digestive enzymes and fluids like gastric juice. And so there should be a mixing motion. So at one point in time, we have these three separate chambers. Then these muscles here relax, and the muscle in the middle starts to contract so that now we have a circumstance like this. And if we look, we see all the compartments are half of one and half of another, right? So these compartments are just mixing together, and it mixes some more, and eventually we come up with a nice homogeneous mixture of food, right, and digestive enzymes. So that's what we call segmentation. Segmentation is a mixing of things. Okay, so let's talk about these things in order of how they move through the digestive system. So we have salivary glands. Salivary glands, we said, secrete saliva, digestive enzymes, and mucus. And we produce about 1.5 liters of saliva every day. Right, so does anybody have a liter container in here? Not really. I see maybe a quarter of a liter. Right? Yeah, there's a liter. Oh, 1.5 of those things right there. That's a tremendous amount. And remember that saliva is secreted into the alimentary canal, and that's really outside your body. So you're losing that fluid because it's entering the alimentary canal, and you have to be concerned about that because if you lose a lot of fluids, you could dehydrate. Right? That's a very serious issue. All right, so salivary glands, you lose fluid. The stomach, all right, is important for storing and mixing. So there's a lot of segmentation that's taking place in the stomach. And I told you. What kind of motility is mixing? Yeah, it's segmentation, right? And so here is the stomach. So when we eat food, it ends up in the stomach, and you can see that it's a big kind of flaccid organ, kind of looks like a bladder. And kind of looks like the gallbladder, kind of looks like the urinary bladder, which we haven't looked at just yet. But it holds food until the time that the small intestine is ready to, is ready to do its work on that food that we have eaten. So there's very little digestion that takes place in the stomach, and even less absorption of nutrients. Mostly this is just the place where food waits until the small intestine is ready to work on that material. All right, so let's talk about some of the things that the stomach does. There is something that's called gastric juice that is secreted into the stomach. There's hydrochloric acid, where we have hydrochloric acid. We have hydrochloric acid, and that's necessary for some of the initial digestion of proteins. There is one enzyme called pepsin that works with hydrochloric acid to produce that actually does a little initial digestion of proteins, but not the major digestion of proteins. And there is something called intrinsic factor that's secreted by the stomach. And this is really the only thing that is absorbed in the stomach, and that's vitamin B12. An intrinsic factor is a compound that's necessary for you to absorb vitamin B12. But you don't absorb the building blocks of proteins in the stomach. What's a building block of a protein? Anybody know? Amino acids. So you don't absorb amino acids. Right? And what's the building block of a complex sugar like starch? Yeah, glucose. It's a monosaccharide. And the building blocks of a lipid. Anybody know what the building blocks of a lipid are? Okay, cholesterol is a kind of lipid. Very good. Another kind is a triglyceride. Probably heard triglyceride. Maybe you've had them measured in your body before. Right? And so triglyceride has fatty acids that make it up. So fatty acids are a building block of a triglyceride. So triglycerides are not absorbed from the stomach either. So stomach is mostly for mixing and storage, a little initial digestion, and that's about it. Okay. Well, on Thanksgiving, we said that every day, the stomach holds food, and on Thanksgiving, what can somebody do? What do most people do?
Overeat,
right? So the stomach actually stretches. It gets bigger, right? And then we eat some more, and the stomach can actually stretch all the way down to the urinary bladder without perforating. And hopefully that didn't ever happen to you, because I don't know how many calories that would be. Maybe 5,000, 10,000 calories. Okay, so don't do that on Memorial Day weekend. It's way too many calories. But it doesn't really hurt the stomach because it has some special features. Let's look inside of a stomach. Okay. Yeah, it's got these special features to it. Okay, let's look right here. All right, so here's the stomach. And it has all of these folds. These folds can stretch out and allows the stomach to hold more food. All right, these things are called rugae. And it has all the same layers that we just talked about, except in the muscularis externa, there are three layers of smooth muscle, which aids in segmentation. So what else do you want to know? Here's an exam figure. So let's look at some of the gross anatomy. So here is the esophagus. It's a tube between where? Where does the esophagus go? Between oral cavity and stomach, right? And the parts of the stomach, so this is how food enters, here's how food leaves through the pyloric sphincter. A sphincter is just a circular smooth muscle. So let's talk about some of the things in between these two doorways. So this is the cardiac region. Sometimes we call that the cardia. Sometimes there's a bit of a smooth muscle, circular smooth muscle right here. We can call that the cardiac sphincter, but it's a very weak muscle. And I see it's not even drawn on this diagram. And on some people, it's super, super weak. So it can never really close off the stomach, can never really isolate the stomach from the esophagus. So when that hydrochloric acid is secreted into the stomach, it can actually move back up into the esophagus and damage the esophagus. Right, so we call that esophageal reflux disease. So here's the cardiac region. Now you see this bump right here. This is the fundus. Right, so the region is the fundus, this is the fundic region. Now how would you describe, where is the fundus located compared to the cardiac region? Where is it located? Yes, I think everybody should say that. Where is that fundic region located compared to the cardiac region? Not everybody said it. You got to say it out loud.
Superior.
Yeah, because I don't know how to say it any better than that, and about half the students in here will miss that question. And I'm just astonished as to why I can't communicate where that is, right? So on a practicum, I'll put a pin right here and ask what's the region, and a lot of people are going to say cardiac region. You don't want to say cardiac region, you want to say fundus. Yeah, fundus. So maybe draw a straight line just like this, right? The cardiac region is going to be below that line, the fundic region is going to be above that line. So one of the jobs of the fundus is just to allow gases that are produced by the stomach just to kind of float up to the surface here and not cause problems. Okay, the body of the stomach then is below the fundic region, outside of the cardiac region, and then we have the pyloric region. Pyloric region has what we call that pyloric sphincter. Now that's a super strong muscle. Right, and here's a little bit of a narrowing of the stomach. We call that the pyloric canal. And the entry into the pyloric canal, we just call that the pyloric antrum. It's kind of like a vestibule into the pyloric canal. The other things that we see are the lesser curvature, right, which is how would we want to call that? This is on the right side of the stomach, and the greater curvature is on the left side, because I can't really say superior, medial, or lateral because these things curve around. So probably right and left is the best way to say it. Maybe one way is superior. The lesser curvature might be superior, but don't forget the greater curvature goes way up over here as well. Okay. So that's pretty good for the stomach, except for some of the glands. So let's see if we can find some of these glands for the stomach. Yep. Okay, so here are some glands. And so we can see the longitudinal circular layer, oblique layer of the stomach. And when we look at the surface of the stomach, not only do we see all these folds or rugae, but we find these little holes, right? And we call these pits, because if you go through this hole, you get into this deep pit right here, and we call that a gastric pit. And this is part of the stomach that's responsible for producing and releasing hydrochloric acid, for producing pepsin, right? And pepsin will break down proteins. These cells will secrete pepsin in an inactive form, but when it mixes with hydrochloric acid in the stomach, then it becomes activated. And that helps prevent the stomach from digesting itself. There is, so the inactive form of pepsin is what we call pepsinogen. So let's look over here. All right, so here we see pepsinogen. That has an important little key feature to the word. It has a suffix. A suffix is something that comes at the end of the word, and it tells you that this particular molecule is inactive but ready to become active at any instant. And it is ogen. Anytime you see a word with ogen, like angiotensinogen, it means it's inactive. But it can be converted into an active form very quickly. All right, so pepsinogen, inactive form, becomes activated by hydrochloric acid. There are different cells in that gastric pit. Right, the parietal cells secrete hydrochloric acid, right, and the chief cells secrete the digestive enzymes like pepsin. So they work together. There are also goblet cells. What's the job of a goblet cell in this epithelium? What's the job of a goblet cell? Yeah, it secretes mucus. Mucus is a protein. Proteins are pretty tough in general, right? And it covers the surface, right, the mucosa of the stomach and prevents the stomach from being digested with the digestive enzymes. So those goblet cells are really important. It's a protective layer, right? It secretes mucus, which is a protective layer of the stomach. And there are even some stem cells in these gastric pits, because you can imagine if you were in an environment all the time that was very acidic and enzymes that were breaking down all the components inside your cell, you'd have a very short lifetime. And indeed, there is very high turnover of cells in the stomach. Right? So about every 3 to 6 days, you get a new lining of the stomach, and it's the stem cells that then reproduce those cells that take over the job of the cells that are just wearing out. So that's pretty interesting, every 3 to 6 days. All right, so we said that the gastric pits secrete fluids like acids and pepsin and a lipase, a gastric lipase. And so the stomach empties fluid. The wall of the stomach empties fluid into the stomach proper, and we see that it secretes about 1.5 liters of fluid into the digestive tract. And remember that your alimentary canal is really outside of your body, so you're losing that water, and you could become dehydrated once again. So how much water have you lost so far? We've gone through the oral cavity, saliva. How much saliva is being produced every day? This is about what? About 1 liter?
Yeah.
1 liter of saliva, 1.5 gastric juice. So far you've lost 2.5 liters of fluid, which is more than one of those big soda bottles of fluid. So again, you should be concerned about dehydration. What's happening to all of that fluid? All right, so then when the small intestine is ready to do its job, it's not too busy with other food, then the pyloric sphincter relaxes, the stomach pushes by peristalsis material into the small intestine. So I want you to know what the function of the small intestine is, and it is digestion and absorption. That's the most important function. What was the most important function of the stomach? Storing and mixing. Small intestine is digestion and absorption. And digestion is just breaking down large molecules into their building blocks, like proteins into amino acids. Complex sugars down into simple sugars. And complex fats, okay, into, for instance, like fatty acids. And look how much fluid is secreted by the small intestine. Almost 2 liters of intestinal juice is secreted into the small intestine. Oh my goodness. So how many is that? We were what, at 2.5, 3.5? Now almost 4 liters of fluid have been lost by your body, right, and secreted into the alimentary canal. So now what are you really concerned about? Dehydration, losing all of that fluid. All right, so just keep in mind all of that fluid that we're losing. The small intestine, like we measured mentioned before, has these 3 divisions. The duodenum is closest to what organ? Duodenum is closest to the stomach, right? And the ileum is closest to the large intestine, and jejunum is right smack in the middle. All right, if we look at a section of small intestine, like we have right here, it kind of looks like a garden hose. It looks nice and flat and smooth on the outside. But on the inside, is it flat and smooth? Do you see a nice flat, smooth surface right here? No, I see all these folds. On the brain, we call those convolutions. And you could call these things convolutions in the small intestine as well. All right, but since they wrap around in a transverse fashion in the small intestine, we call these circular folds, or sometimes plicae circularis, or circular, just circular folds. All right, so what this does, it increases the surface area for absorption, right? So anytime you see a surface area, what should you think of? Like a doorway, right, for material to move in and out. So even though the small intestine is relatively short, if we were to take 2 ends of the small intestine and stretch it out to flatten out all of these circular folds, then it would be much, much longer, meaning that the surface area for absorption is increased. But that's not the only other specialization. Do you see some other folds besides these large, gross folds? We see some almost microscopic folds that we call villi. You can almost see them with your naked eye, but for sure you can tell that the surface, if you were to look at small intestine, you can tell that the surface of the small intestine is not flat and smooth, but kind of velvety looking because of all these villi. And so again, we could pull on the ends of the small intestine and flatten all of these villi out, and that would mean that the small intestine was even longer, right? So the surface area increases once again. So there are, we've talked about 2 things that increase the length of the small intestine, even though it fits in our small abdominal cavity, and it also increases the surface area for absorption. Those were what? The circular folds and the villi. All right, so here is a nice example of a villus. And if we look even at the epithelium right here, guess what's right on the surface of the epithelium? You see more folds, and these folds are called microvilli, right? And there are thousands of these things on every cell. So if we really want to consider what the length of the small intestine is, not only do we have to stretch it gently to stretch out the circular folds, stretch it some more to get rid of all the villi, straighten out all these villi right here, but we have to stretch it out to get rid of all of these thousands of microvilli as well. So you can imagine that the surface area for the small intestine is huge as a result of that. Okay, so when I look at this villus right here, right, I see that it is a simple columnar epithelium, and I see some goblet cells in there secrete mucus onto the villus that protects it from digestion. I see a red vessel right here. What does that red vessel remind you of? An artery, right? An artery. And then I see a blue vessel. Here is a vein, right? And I've got some capillaries in between. And the capillaries specialize for what kind of function?
Exchange,
right? So nutrients can be absorbed by this villus and it can enter the circulatory system. And so typically amino acids do and sugars do, but not lipids. Lipids enter our body, even though they're emulsified, and they're not placed directly in the blood, but they get absorbed by a special kind of lymphatic vessel. When we talked about the lymphatic system, we mentioned this, and this is what we call a lacteal. Right? A lacteal is just a lymph capillary which absorbs lipids. Okay, and then those lipids are even processed some more. So here you have that villus. Villus also has some smooth muscle in it, so these things are actually wiggling around inside your small intestine, and that is really a form of mixing. Right? And so that mixing, what's the function of that mixing? Well, a good way to think of that, let's just say, how about you have a pan, you got some water in it, and you want to heat that water up, and you've got your stove up as high as possible. Okay, what's a good way, probably, that you do to increase or to decrease the time it takes to get that water to boil? You can maybe put some salt in it, adulterate the fluid a little bit, but also stir it up so that the cold parts of that fluid get down to the hot part of the pan and it starts to boil faster. Right? What's another way of making water boil faster? You could put it in a bigger pan, right, with more area where the flame is going to touch. So stirring that fluid is just like making the pan bigger. Right? So when these things are moving around, that's a stirring kind of motion. What does that do? That increases the surface area for absorption, right? Because it has smooth muscles. So functionally, those smooth muscles, because it allows some mixing to take place, it increases the surface area or that area for absorption as well. Okay, so there are some, you can see some holes in the small intestine, and these are not what we call pits, but these are what we call crypts. They're not quite as deep, and they have some cells that secrete hormones that control contraction of smooth muscle in the stomach, for instance, because when the small intestine starts to distend and stretch, that means that it is full, and those hormones then send a signal to the stomach to quiet down a little bit because the small intestine is busy doing its job. Right, the intestinal crypts also secrete enzymes into the lumen of the small intestine. Enzymes to digest proteins and sugars and lipids come from this area right here. All right, so we made a big deal of the things that increase the surface area of the small intestine for absorption. So if we were to think of the small intestine as just a nice flat straight tube without the plicae circularis, without the villi, without the microvilli, and without the mixing function of each of those microvilli, the surface area for exchange would be about 3.5 square feet. I don't know what that is. It's not very big. Right? That would be the doorway for absorption. Right? But don't forget, we really got to flatten all these things out. So let's remove the plicae circularis by flattening them out, and the villi, and the microvilli. Well, now, the functional surface area is 2,200 square feet. So it went from 3.5 to 2,200. So that's a huge increase. And that is there for exchange. So what is the surface area? What does a surface area look like? 2,200 square feet. Yeah, it's very big, right? Very, very big. About 240 square meters, if you can think in meters. But I can think in terms of houses, right? That's the floor area of an average two-level house. All right, so, but that's the doorway you need for exchange. All right, so you got capillaries in those villi to absorb sugars and amino acids. The lacteals absorb fat. Right, and what about these intestinal glands? The Brunner's glands secrete a viscous alkaline mucus. Alkaline means it's opposite compared to an acid, because remember, the contents coming from the stomach are very acid, super acidic, maybe a pH of 1 or 2. It's hard to get any more acidic than that. And that acid would damage the small intestine, so these crypts secrete a base to neutralize those acids. The enterocytes secrete intestinal juice with digestive enzymes. The enteroendocrine cells secrete hormones like secretin and cholecystokinin. Secretin goes to the stomach and it calms the stomach down. Cholecystokinin goes to the gallbladder and it causes the gallbladder to contract. And when it does, bile then enters the small intestine to emulsify the lipids in the small intestine. And just like in the stomach, right, you get a new lining of the small intestine about every 3 to 6 days. So there is a high turnover. It's a highly proliferative part of your body. And you might be aware of this because you might be aware, for instance, if somebody's on chemotherapy, one of the side effects of chemotherapy is indigestion, or gives you a sense of nausea. And why is that? Because chemotherapeutic agents will specifically act on certain kinds of cells that are growing rapidly, like cancer cells. Right? So it doesn't only affect cancer cells, but any kind of cell that is dividing rapidly, like for instance the lining of your digestive tract. So a lot of chemotherapeutic agents also attack the lining of the digestive tract, which then makes somebody feel really nauseated. And the small intestine also has a lot of immune tissue in it, like MALT, and it helps fight infection, right? Because there's bacteria in this area, and we don't want that bacteria getting into the rest of your body. There are areas that we call Peyer's patches, especially in the ileum, that is just a special aggregation of MALT in that region. Pancreas. I want to skip over the pancreas and come back because that's an accessory structure. I want to stick with the elementary canal. So from the small intestine, where does it go after that? Into the large intestine. Yeah, so it goes into the large intestine. Let's see if I can find something that looks like a large intestine right here. Almost close. All right, so the last part of the small intestine is what we call the ileum. And it enters into the large intestine right here, and you can see all these pockets in the large intestine. We call those haustra. They have muscles that attach to the central tendon. We call this a tinea coli. And the job of the large intestine is no longer for digestion that has taken place in the small intestine, and it is not for absorption of nutrients like amino acids and sugars and things like that. So you might be wondering, well, why do you have this big, huge structure right here? And that's where I want you to think about all that fluid that a person puts into their digestive tract for digestion. How much fluid was placed there so far? Salivary glands, 1.5 liters. Stomach, did we say, almost 2 liters. Small intestine, I think was 1.5 liters. Let's go take a look. Is it 1.5 liters? Secreted, stomach, small intestine. Oh, I know I say in here someplace. Okay. The small intestine. Almost 2 liters of fluid from the small intestine. So that's almost 5 liters of fluid that your body is going to lose just in working with these digestive processes. So we don't want to lose that fluid. So the most important function of the large intestine right here is to absorb water that was secreted by your mouth, by the stomach, by the small intestine. All right, and when water is resorbed or absorbed from the large intestine, that's just another way of saying fecal formation. All right, so that produces fecus. And there are bacteria within the large intestine. Those bacteria can digest any number of things that are there, including nutrients. So for instance, if the small intestine doesn't completely digest and absorb a nutrient, it could be some kind of protein or sugar, and it enters the large intestine, then there are things in the large intestine that are really happy to accept all of that energy, right? So those bacteria start to metabolize it, they grow, right, and produce a lot of gas and distend the large intestine, and increases motility of the large intestine. And then somebody produces copious amounts of watery stool when that happens. So nutrients should be absorbed by the small intestine, not by the large intestine. If nutrients get into the large intestine, we call that malabsorption syndrome. All right. So, but what is really the bad thing about malabsorption syndrome? Well, a number of bad things. We said watery stool, so you are dehydrating as a result because now you're not producing feces, you're losing all of that water. All right, some of the bacteria produce vitamins like vitamin K, which is important for clotting function. So you'll have suppressed clotting function as well. All right, but the most important thing is losing all of that water plus electrolytes. your electrolyte balance, the different salts that you need in your body, all right, will also come out of balance. There was a drug not too long ago, and it was reintroduced recently with a different name. It was a drug called Xenical. And Xenical was just an oral medication, and when it got into the small intestine, it would bind fats or lipids that were in your diet, and it prevented the absorption of lipids. Right? So you weren't absorbing lipids because of Xenical, but where did all those lipids go? From the small intestine into the large intestine. Right? And so lipid is a very highly energetic molecule, right? And so what happened in the large intestine? What's living in this large intestine? All of those bacteria. So now, since you didn't absorb those lipids in the small intestine, those bacteria use it as an energy source, right? And they proliferate, they grow and produce a lot of gas, irritates the large intestine, and that produces copious amounts of stool as well, right? But not just watery stool, but oily watery stool. And it's so oily and slippery that when somebody was on Xenical, they couldn't even tell when they were stooling themselves. So what would you have to wear when you were on Xenical? Well, you'd have to wear a diaper. That's right, right? Because you couldn't tell. It has recently been reintroduced, and the new formulary is a little bit less of a concentration of that compound, and I don't know what the side effects are. I probably would like to talk to a lot of other people before I would agree to take it for myself, right? So anytime the small intestine isn't doing its job, that produces, what does that produce in the large intestine? Malabsorption syndrome, and that produces dehydration and loss of electrolytes. Okay, so malabsorption syndrome. And a lot of times, you might be taking a medication and the medication says one of the side effects is diarrhea. And so probably you could figure out what that medication is doing, right? If you're taking a medication and one of the side effects is copious amounts of watery stool, then you could surmise that that medication is doing its job, but one of the side effects is that it's preventing the absorption of some nutrient in the small intestine, and that's producing malabsorption syndrome. That's almost always the case. Okay, so what are some other things with this large intestine? Here is some lymphatic tissue, the appendix. There is a nice circular smooth muscle. What do we call a circular smooth muscle? A sphincter, right? And a circular skeletal muscle is a orbicularis muscle, right? But these are sphincters. These are smooth muscles. And so this is called, it's named after the tubes that it is connected to. So this is the ileocecal valve. And so this part of the small intestine is the cecum. Here's the ascending. Here's the transverse, right? We went over that. Here is that 90-degree bend or flexure. And what organ is right up over here? On the right side, yeah, here's the liver. Then over here is the spleen. Yeah, stomach. And the spleen actually is hanging down just a little bit lower. So you could call this the left colic flexure or the splenic flexure. That's the same thing. Here's the right colic flexure or hepatic. That is exactly the same thing. These pockets are what we call haustra. One pocket is a haustrum. So here's a haustrum. Here are 1, 2, 3 haustra. And we also see these little fatty appendages right here coming from the tinea coli. Right? We all have them, but none of us know why they are there. I have no clue, but they're there. Okay, what else about the large intestine? Okay, depending on your genetic makeup, it's prone to develop cancers. Right? First, the cancers are in a precursor form called polyps, and if a polyp isn't removed, it will turn cancerous, and colon cancer certainly can be deadly. So how can you protect yourself from colon cancer? It's really a shame that anybody dies of colon cancer. There might be some circumstances that you can't recognize and treat, but in most cases, it's easily treated, okay? You don't have to die from colon cancer, because what can you do? You can get a colonoscopy or a sigmoidoscopy, right? So a physician or a technologist will insert a camera up through the anal canal into the sigmoid colon, right? So a sigmoidoscopy will be able to view the inside of the large intestine, at least to this level, right? And of course, then it's not long enough to look at the descending colon. And a lot of times when somebody has a sigmoidoscopy, the result will be inconclusive, which means then that what's recommended is a colonoscopy, and then you have to go back and actually get the whole large intestine viewed at that time. They're not usually done back to back. All right, so I guess I would recommend if it's your time to have your large intestine viewed for cancer, and if you don't mind having it done twice, you can have a sigmoidoscopy and a colonoscopy, but what should you just ask for right away? Might as well just get a colonoscopy right away, because the difficult thing is not lying unconscious with these tubes in your large intestine, but if there's feces in the large intestine, then they can't see what's in there. They can't look at the wall. So the difficult thing about a colonoscopy or a sigmoidoscopy, and it's the exact same nuisance, is that you have to clean out the large intestine. Right? And there is a fluid, and the physician will, depending on what they like, will maybe recommend a couple of different things. Sometimes an enema, they will recommend an enema. Some physicians will actually recommend that you drink a fluid that increases the motility of the large intestine, but it has a special electrolyte balance in there so that you don't get an imbalance of water or sodium and potassium in your body. And it really has a misnomer, right? It's called go lightly. Okay, and you don't go lightly. You go very heavily. But if you look at the name carefully, the light part is not L-I-G-H-T, it's L-Y-T-E, which stands for electrolytes, right? Electrolyte balance, like sodium and potassium. All right, so the other recommendation is, if you don't do the preparation correctly and the physician, right, looks around in here and can't see anything because there's too much feces, guess what you have to do again? Need to reschedule? And you need to drink that gallon of Go Lightly again, right? So as you're drinking that stuff, you might feel, oh, well, this is really obnoxious. I'm only going to drink a half a gallon. Would that be a good decision on your part? No, because chances are you're going to end up drinking 1.5 gallons, right? And if you get it wrong the second time, then you're going to end up drinking 2 gallons of this stuff. So the best thing to do is do exactly what the physician says to prepare the large intestine so that they can do a nice job looking around. Okay, one last thing. With that colonoscopy, you can have it done with anesthesia or without, and what would you choose?
With,
absolutely. Okay, so probably don't ever get talked into getting a colonoscopy without anesthesia. And the drugs they use are really nice. They're fast-acting, which means that they act for only a short period of time. And you won't even hardly know that you were absent from consciousness. You'll pass out and come right back to life, but you probably still shouldn't drive home. Okay, so make sure you get anesthesia as well. And next time I'll tell you how many people die of colon cancer. And it's really a shame because it's so easy to recognize early, right, just to remove a polyp and then you don't even get cancer. So it's just a shame so many people die, right? So especially if you have family history, make sure your family goes and gets their colonoscopy, right? Okay, help them out somehow if you can. All right, so we'll finish up the digestive system next week.